Have you ever wondered how a ragtag startup actually transforms into a multi-billion dollar behemoth?
Oh, like legally speaking.
Right, exactly. Legally speaking, because you always hear these stories of, a couple people in a garage sketching out an idea on a
That
napkin.
a classic Silicon Valley myth.
Right. And then a few years later, they are suddenly acquiring competitors, they're fielding massive venture capital and ringing the bell for an IPO.
It's wild.
It is. And if you are on the outside looking in, it feels like magic, but it's not magic. It is corporate law.
It absolutely is. And usually we only think about corporate law when something goes terribly wrong.
Oh, for sure. Like a famous CEO getting sued.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's actually the invisible scaffolding that holds the entire business world together.
Yeah. And that is exactly the mission of this deep dive. Today, we are looking at the 2026 edition of U.S. Corporate Law, a comprehensive guide.
Which was put together by the American newspaper and American TV.
Right. And our goal today is to give you, the listener, the ultimate cheat sheet on how companies are born, how they're governed, and ultimately how they are sold.
And I think the first thing to realize here is that U.S. corporate law is not just one giant monolithic rule book sitting on a shelf somewhere in Washington, D.C.
It's not.
No, not at all. It is a highly complex, layered system. You have federal law, state law, and private contracts, and they're all just overlapping.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. And together, they determine who has power, how they're allowed to use that power, and what happens when they abuse it.
Okay, well, let's unpack this because that layered system, I mean, it sounds like a bureaucratic nightmare for a founder who's just trying to build a product.
Oh, it definitely can be.
So, where do you even begin to untangle that?
Well, a good corporate lawyer always asks five questions in a very specific sequence to figure out what rules apply.
Okay, what's the first one?
First, they ask, which legal person or transaction are we actually talking about?
Makes sense.
Second, which jurisdiction supplies the internal affairs law?
Wait, I want to stop you on that second question about internal affairs.
Sure.
Let's say you and I start a software company, right? We live in California, our office is in California, our employees are in California. Doesn't California law govern how we run the company?
Actually, not necessarily.
Wait, really?
Yeah, that's the beauty and the complexity, honestly, of the internal affairs doctrine. It was solidified in a major Supreme Court case called CTS Corp.
Oh.
And the doctrine dictates that matters peculiar to the relationships among the corporation, its directors, and its stockholders, all of that is governed strictly by the law of the state of incorporation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Not where your headquarters is, not where your servers are, but where you filed your foundational paperwork.
Which brings us to the elephant in the room, I guess. Delaware.
Always Delaware.
Right, because it seems like virtually every major venture-backed startup and Fortune 500 company incorporates in Delaware. Is there like something in the water there? Why not just incorporate where you live?
Well, it's not the water, it's a predictability. I mean, businesses absolutely despise uncertainty.
Sure.
So Delaware has become the dominant choice for a few very specific structural reasons.
Yeah.
First off, they have a highly specialized court called the Court of Chancery.
Okay, what makes it special?
There are no juries. The judges, who are called chancellors, are dedicated corporate law experts.
Oh, I see. So you aren't explaining complex venture capital math to a random jury of people who just want to go home.
Exactly. I mean, this means you get speed, you get expertise, and above all, you get a massive body of legal precedent.
Right, because they've seen it all before.
Exactly. If a board of directors is about to make a risky move, their lawyers can look at decades of Delaware Chancery decisions and predict with really high accuracy how a judge will react.
That's huge.
It is. It allows companies to effectively price their governance risk.
And they actively maintain that dominance too. I was looking at the 2025 amendments to the Delaware General Corporation Law, the
Right.
DGCL.
Oh, yeah, those are significant.
Yeah, they updated Section 144 to provide really detailed statutory protections for conflict transactions, like when a company goes private.
Right.
And they tightened up Section 220, which strictly defines exactly what categories of books and records a stockholder is allowed to demand access to. They don't just let the laws get stale.
No, they keep the machinery well-oiled.
Yeah.
It's very much an active partnership between the state legislature and the corporate bar.
It makes me think of the US legal system for corporations like a magic multiplayer video game.
Oh, I like that. How so?
Well, the federal government sets the overarching server rules, right?
Yeah.
The securities laws and federal taxes that apply to everyone playing the game, no matter where they are.
Yeah.
But Delaware, Delaware essentially writes the specific physics engine for how the players actually interact, collide, and cooperate with each other inside the game.
That is a brilliant way to look at it, the physics engine. And what's fascinating here is a concept Delaware courts use, which is that equity twice tests conduct.
Equity twice tests conduct. Okay, what does that mean?
Well, it originates from a famous case, Schnell v. Chris Kraft.
Oh.
The court basically established that just because an action is legally possible under the statutes of the physics engine doesn't mean it's equitable or permissible.
Wait, let me make sure I have this straight. You can follow the rules of the game perfectly, check every single legal box.
Yes.
But the judges can still look at you and say, yeah, but you were being underhanded about it, so you lose.
Precisely. The law separates legal power from the equitable use of that power.
Huh.
So, for example, a board of directors might have the technical, statutory right to change the date of a shareholder meeting.
Sure.
But if they change that date solely to ambush a group of dissident shareholders and prevent them from voting.
Oh, that's shady.
Very. And the Court of Equity will step in and strike it down. The process matters just as much as the rule.
Wow. Okay, so we know why everyone plugs into Delaware's physics engine, but how do you actually step onto the playing field?
That's the next big hurdle.
Because reading through the source material, it turns out that getting a birth certificate for your company isn't the same thing as actually raising the child.
No, it's not. And that is a critical distinction that trips up a lot of first-time entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
You have to separate formation from organization.
Okay, break that down for us.
Well, formation is simply filing your certificate of incorporation with the Delaware Secretary of State.
The paperwork.
Right. Once that document is stamped, congratulations, the legal person exists. But it's an empty shell. It has no brain, no nervous system, and no money.
Right. It can't actually do anything yet.
Exactly. Then comes organization. And this is the heavy lifting.
Okay.
This is where you adopt the corporate bylaws, you appoint a board of directors, you appoint officers like a CEO, open a bank account, and crucially, legally authorize and issue stock.
And this is where so many founder disputes seem to ignite.
Oh, constantly.
You get these eager founders who put 50% next to their names on a spreadsheet like a capitalization table or cap table, but they skip the actual legal formalities.
Yes, and it's a fatal error. A cap table is just an economic model. It's, you know, a hypothetical spreadsheet.
Right.
It is not the legal stock ledger of the corporation. If the board of directors didn't pass legal resolutions to authorize the shares, and you didn't legally purchase them for valid consideration, you do not own them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what your spreadsheet says.
So if you are listening to this and you've got a startup idea, pay attention to this next part. Even when you do legally get the stock, it's not like you just put it in a safe and walk away.
Definitely not.
The sources dive into a mechanism called reverse vesting, which, I mean, it sounds totally backwards.
It does sound backwards, but it's actually a brilliant survival mechanism for startups.
How so?
Well, with normal vesting, you earn your shares over time. With reverse vesting, the founder technically owns all their issued shares on day one, and they can vote them.
Okay.
But those shares are subject to a declining repurchase right by the company if the founder leaves.
Oh, I get it. So if we start a company and use a standard 4-year schedule with a 1-year cliff, if I get mad and quit after 6 months, I don't get to keep half the company.
Exactly. The company has the right to buy back all your unvested shares, usually for fractions of a penny.
Wow.
It protects the company and the investors, honestly, from a co-founder walking away early and sitting on massive equity while everyone else does the hard work.
But wait, doesn't that trigger an absolute nightmare scenario with taxes? The infamous IRS 83B election.
Oh, yes.
Paint the picture for us. Like, how bad can this get?
It is the stuff of nightmares for startup lawyers. Because your stock is subject to that reverse vesting, the IRS views it as property you haven't fully earned yet.
Okay.
So normally they want to tax you as the stock vests year over year based on its value at that exact moment.
So imagine you start a company in your garage. Your stock is worth practically zero. 2 years later, you've blown up and the company is valued at $100 million.
Right. And because a chunk of your shares vested that year at the new $100 million valuation, the IRS hands you a tax bill for millions of dollars on phantom income.
Phantom income, because you haven't even sold anything.
Exactly. You haven't sold any shares. You have no cash to pay the tax. But the IRS demands their cut.
That is terrifying.
Which is exactly why you file an 83B election.
Okay, what is that?
It's a document you send to the IRS telling them, hey, tax me on the value of this stock right now.
Yeah.
On day one, when it's basically worthless.
Ah, smart.
You pay a tiny tax up front to avoid the phantom income trap later. But, and this is a massive, you have a strict, unforgiving 30-day window to file that paperwork after receiving the stock.
Only 30 days.
Yes. Miss by one day, and there's generally no late election discretion. You are locked into the nightmare.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting to me. We use the word founder all the time in business culture, right? We idolize founders.
We do.
But legally speaking, the title of founder is just an economic label. It is not a statutory office. That's right.
Wait, hold on. You're telling me that if I build a company from scratch, my title as founder offers me zero legal protection if things go south?
Zero. This is a harsh reality check for entrepreneurs. The law does not care about the emotional weight of the word founder.
Ouch.
Yeah. A founder's legal power to run the company comes strictly from three tangible things. The voting power of the stock they own, the seat they hold on the board of directors, or the delegated authority they have if the board appoints them as an officer, like CEO.
That's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
If you are voted off the board, fired as CEO, and your voting power is diluted by investors, the title of founder will not legally save you.
Which takes us right into the architecture of how these companies are actually run. Since founder isn't a shield, we have to look at the governance triad, the three-headed monster, basically.
The three-headed monster, yeah.
So how does this power triangle actually work?
Well, the triad consists of the stockholders, the directors, and the officers.
The stockholders are the owners, but they do not manage the company. Their primary power is electing the board and voting on massive fundamental matters, like whether to merge or dissolve.
Okay, so the owners elect the directors.
Right, and the board of directors manages or directs the business and affairs of the corporation. They set the overarching strategy, they approve big budgets, and they make the major decisions.
Got it.
And then the board appoints the officers, the CEO, CFO, and so on, who are the delegated agents that actually run the day-to-day operations.
But the board doesn't just get to sit in a room and do whatever they want, right? They have a leash. And it's made of fiduciary duties.
A very tight leash.
The materials highlight three main ones: the duty of care, the duty of loyalty, and the duty of oversight. Let's break these down. How do these actually work in practice?
So, the duty of care isn't about making a decision that guarantees a profit. It's about the process. A famous case, Smith v. Van Gorkum, established that directors must act on an informed basis after a deliberative process.
Meaning you can't just blindly approve a merger after a 20-minute meeting without reading the financial reports.
Exactly. Then you have the duty of loyalty, which traces back to Guth v. Loft. This means putting the company first.
Mm.
You cannot engage in self-dealing or steal a corporate opportunity for your own side hustle.
Right. And the third one, the duty of oversight.
This is often called the Caremark Doctrine. A board must implement reporting systems for mission-critical risks and actively respond to red flags.
Like what?
Well, for example, if you run a national ice cream brand, food safety is mission critical. If the board completely ignores reports of listeria in the factories and fails to monitor those risks, they can face personal liability for the fallout.
Yikes. So if a board is sued for breaching these duties, how does a judge actually evaluate them? The sources mentioned three standards of review: the business judgment rule, entire fairness, and enhanced scrutiny.
Right.
Is the business judgment rule basically a legal benefit of the doubt shield for directors, so long as they aren't asleep at the wheel or stealing from the cookie jar?
That is exactly how to frame it. The business judgment rule is a powerful legal presumption that the board acted properly, on an informed basis, and in good faith.
Okay.
If that rule applies, the court will defer to the board's decision, even if the product failed and the company lost millions. Courts do not want to run companies or second-guess legitimate business risks taken in good faith.
Right. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, process is everything in Delaware. But what if they mess up? What if a director is on both sides of a deal, say, the corporation is buying real estate owned by one of its own board members? Do they lose that benefit of the doubt?
They lose it entirely. The court shifts away from the business judgment rule and applies the entire fairness standard.
That sounds intense.
It is a brutal place for a board to be. The burden of proof flips onto the directors to prove to the court that both the dealing process and the price were entirely fair to the stockholders.
Are they just doomed at that point? Is there any escape hatch for a board that accidentally steps into a conflicted transaction?
There actually is an escape hatch, and it's known as Corwin cleansing, named after a prominent case.
Cleansing, huh?
Yeah. If a board realizes their process in a transaction was flawed, they can take the deal directly to the stockholders. If an informed, uncoerced majority of the completely disinterested stockholders vote to approve the transaction anyway, that vote cleanses the deal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it restores the protective shield of the business judgment rule.
It's like the ultimate speak now or forever hold your peace. If the shareholders say, we know the process was messy, but we still like the deal, the quote backs off.
Exactly. Though it's worth noting, there's a middle ground called enhanced scrutiny.
When does that apply?
Courts apply this when a board adopts defensive measures against a hostile takeover, or when they're running a process to sell the company entirely.
Okay, so you've built the machine, you've established the governance rules,
yeah.
But the machine needs fuel. It needs cash to grow.
It always needs cash.
Yeah, right. And eventually, the founders and investors want a destination, an exit strategy. But raising money without running afoul of the SEC is a minefield. Let's talk about the Securities Act of 1933.
The golden rule of the 1933 Act is simple. Every single offer and sale of a security must either be fully registered with the SEC, which means a massive, highly regulated public IPO, or it must qualify for a specific exemption.
And for startups, exemptions are life or death.
Absolutely.
You might be wondering, what kind of exemptions exist? The two big ones are Rule 506B and Rule 506C. What is the practical difference for a founder trying to raise a seed round?
Well, it comes down to how you find your investors. Under Rule 506B, you are absolutely forbidden from using general solicitation.
So keep it quiet.
Exactly. You cannot tweet about raising money. You cannot talk about it on a podcast. You cannot put up a billboard. It's a quiet room. But you can raise money from accredited investors, plus up to 35 non-accredited investors, provided you give them detailed disclosures.
Okay, so 506B is the quiet room. Why would anyone choose the headache of 506C?
Because 506C gives you a megaphone.
Ah.
You can use general solicitation. You can tweet about your fundraise to millions of people. But there's a massive catch.
Which is?
Every single purchaser must be a verified, accredited investor. You can't just take their word for it on a simple questionnaire. The company must take strict steps to verify their wealth.
Wow.
Meaning reviewing tax returns, bank statements, or getting official letters from their CPAs.
So you trade the quiet room for an intense administrative headache?
Precisely.
But regardless of which exemption you use, there is an overarching anti-fraud rule, Rule 10b-5.
Always. Exemption from registration does not mean exemption from anti-fraud laws. You cannot lie, and just as importantly, you cannot omit material information.
Great.
Even if you're just showing a private pitch deck to three venture capitalists in a closed room, the statements you make and the cap table you show them must be factual. If you lie or hide debt to get the money, you commit federal securities fraud.
So I guess the question is, what does this all mean when a startup isn't selling traditional priced stock, but using early stage tools like SAFEs, simple agreements for future equity?
Oh, SAFEs.
I hear founders toss these around casually, like they're just IOUs. But the source material talks about the danger to the fully diluted denominator. Break that down for us with a math example.
This is where founders get crushed by their own success.
Sure.
A SAFE is not just a casual IOU. It is a binding contract that dictates future equity dilution.
Okay.
Let's say you use a pre-money SAFE. This means the SAFE converts into shares based on the company's valuation before the new venture capital money is counted. In that scenario, the founders absorb virtually all the dilution from the SAFEs.
Ouch.
If you use a post-money SAFE, the dilution is shared differently.
So if founders aren't actively modeling how these SAFEs convert, like counting every single share, option, and warrant in that fully diluted denominator, what happens?
The math is relentless. They might reach their Series A financing round, finally price the company, and realize that because of how the SAFEs converted, they don't own 60% of the company anymore.
What do they own?
They own 15%.
Wow. The math comes for everyone. But let's say the company survives the dilution, they scale, and now it's time for the exit. M&A, mergers and acquisitions. We have to talk about isolating liabilities using triangular mergers.
Right, because when a massive company buys a startup, they don't want the startup's hidden skeletons like an undisclosed lawsuit or unpaid taxes infecting the parent company's balance sheet.
You know, it makes me think of buying a house, but you're terrified it has termites.
Termites.
Yeah. Instead of moving into the house, you build a reinforced glass box, put the house inside the box, and buy the box. The liabilities, the termites, stay trapped inside.
That is a perfect analogy.
Mm.
In a forward triangular merger, the parent company creates a subsidiary.
Mm-hmm.
The box and the target company, the house merges into the box.
Okay.
The target disappears and the subsidiary survives. In a reverse triangular merger, the parent subsidiary merges into the target company. The target survives, but is a brand new subsidiary of the parent.
Fascinating.
Both structures legally isolate the target's past liabilities away from the parent's main assets.
And when a board officially decides to sell the company in one of these mergers, their legal duty shifts completely, right? This the Revlon duty.
Yes, from the famous Revlon case. Once a board embarks on a transaction that will cause a sale or a change of corporate control, the traditional long-term strategy goes out the window.
So they can't just think about the five-year plan.
No, they can no longer protect the corporate bastion. Their sole fiduciary duty shifts entirely to getting the best financial value reasonably available for the stockholders right now. They essentially become auctioneers.
Okay, we've covered the layered physics engine of Delaware, the formation and the 83B trap, the governance triad, the fundraising rules, and the exit.
That's a lot of ground.
It is. To prove this isn't just abstract textbook theory, let's look at how the biggest tech titans in the world actually utilize or manipulate these exact legal tools. First off, Apple. Everyone assumes the biggest company in the world is a Delaware corporation.
But they aren't. Their public SEC filings clearly identify them as a California corporation.
Wow.
It proves that while Delaware is dominant, a company can absolutely function with state internal affairs law and federal reporting coexisting in a different state.
But then you have reincorporation, which is fascinating. Amazon was formed in Washington but moved to Delaware, and Tesla. This made huge news.
Oh, massive news.
Right. In 2024, Tesla famously converted from a Delaware corporation to a Texas corporation. I want to push back on this because the concept of regulatory federalism is wild. You're telling me a company can have its physical headquarters, its gigafactories, and its CEO sitting in one state, but just by filing some paperwork, it changes the entire legal framework governing its board to a completely different state.
It is wild, but that is exactly how it works. By changing domicile to Texas, all future internal affairs, how the board is governed, stockholder rights, fiduciary duties, all of that will follow Texas law.
That's crazy.
But it's important to note that legacy disputes, like lawsuits over things that happened before the move, might still be litigated under Delaware law.
Right, right. Then you look at how modern founders maintain control. The guide points to Meta. They use a dual-class super-voting stock structure.
Right. This is how you completely separate economic ownership from actual voting control.
Okay.
A founder like Mark Zuckerberg might only own 15% of the economic value of the company, but if his special class of stock gets 10 votes per share while everyone else gets one vote, he easily retains over 50% of the voting control.
So he's untouchable.
He's the unquestioned controller, regardless of how much money investors put in.
And finally, the weirdest corporate structure of all right now, OpenAI.
An incredibly fascinating case study. An official nonprofit foundation directly controls a for-profit public benefit corporation, or PBC.
A nonprofit controlling a for-profit entity that is simultaneously taking in billions of dollars of venture capital. That sounds like a paradox.
It does, yes. But it shows the incredible structural creativity that U.S. corporate law allows if you know how to architect it. They embedded a public benefit mission, developing safe AI alongside a massive capped profit capital raising engine.
So wrapping this all up for you listening, corporate law is not a boring compliance checklist handed to you by a grumpy lawyer.
Definitely not.
It is the literal DNA of the business world. It defines the exact power dynamics between founders, boards, and investors. It provides the specific mechanisms for raising billions of dollars, and it outlines the rules of engagement for executing massive corporate buyouts.
It is the operating system of capitalism. And, you know, this raises an important question, a final thought to leave you with, based on these recent case studies. We spent a lot of time today discussing the internal affairs doctrine and Delaware's absolute dominance over the last century. But look at what is happening right now in the broader landscape. You have Tesla actively fleeing Delaware for Texas in 2024. You have OpenAI abandoning the traditional C Corp entirely for a highly experimental hybrid nonprofit PBC model.
You have Meta relying on dual class workarounds to essentially bypass the traditional board accountability structure.
Exactly. So if the most valuable, innovative, and influential companies of the future are actively rejecting the traditional Delaware shareholder-centric C Corp model, are we currently witnessing the end of a century-long consensus on how American businesses are supposed to be governed? Something for you to chew on until next time.